This is ensemble member Alan Wilder, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
I'm Associate Artistic Director David New, and I'm here with ensemble member Randy Arney, who is the director of Steppenwolf's production of The Seafarer by Connor McPherson. How are you, Randy?
I'm fine. Thanks, David.
Here we are. We're just before the opening night performance, and I haven't done this on a podcast before, but I want to do a spoiler alert just so that you and I feel free to talk about some of the situations and characters in the play. That there are a number of them that are kind of O. Henry twists, and I don't want to reveal that for any of our listeners who might not have seen the productions. Connor McPherson debuts his work in Dublin, is that correct?
That's right,
yeah.
Yes.
And then the production may move to London, and this one did, and then on to New York.
That's right.
So when you first read the play, did you think, I've got to get my hands on this and direct?
I did, David. It was one that, in fact, those of us that work have been fortunate enough to work over a long period of time in this business, it's whenever one really grabs your attention and you know you want to do one, not just because you have a mortgage to pay or whatever, but one really grabs you. And those are really few and far between, and this was one. Part of it was the history that I had with Connor's work on The Weir. He is such a wonderful storyteller, and his characters are so rich, and his ensemble demands are so great, and it's such red meat for actors. So I loved The Weir, and as soon as I heard that there was another one there, I was interested in reading it. And this one, it's more of a full journey in the theater. What I mean by that is in the 2 hours of this play, I find it wildly funny. I find it scary. It is like a carnival ride for the audience. And yet something that is as entertaining as this play is, for it ultimately to resonate as deeply as this play does, is really a special special treat. And there's nothing like hearing an audience enjoy themselves on the ride, but then be standing in the lobby and watching them come out and see actually how deeply it's resonated with them, too. It's poignant as well as funny.
Yeah, when I first read the play, like you, I was just struck by how theatrical it was. Immediately, like, this is fantastic. You know, having then reread it, spent time with it, watched you guys through the rehearsal process and now through previews, it constantly reveals itself in how rich it is, how deep it is, how detailed it is.
Yes.
And the skill of Connor McPherson to reveal character sort of coming at it sideways,
yes,
as opposed to the sort of stand and deliver.
Yes.
It's really fantastic.
Connor has a real understanding of how characters, we all have our public selves and our private selves. And when a group of guys are together to play cards, there is a machismo in the room. There is a real need for all of these guys to be seen by their very good friends and peers as being whatever member of the group that they are. And by having that shield put up in place, it really makes what's all going on underneath it fun to reveal in drips and drabs, and through alcohol and through the lateness of the hour, these guys' guards come down at really interesting times, and because of that, I think you get a real three-dimensional sense of all of these people. I also just love his plays are full of such, as you say, texture and sensory richness in the surroundings and in the possibilities for lighting and the possibilities for sound. And playwriting is such an unbelievably creative venture. When you get to the end of a play and realize that playwright had to give you all the information that you just got and had to do it only in dialogue and make that feel like it's people that are just thinking of things and talking to each other, and yet somehow you come away with such a rich tapestry of relationships and emotions and in fact a story. You learn more about characters than you know about your own family members. And a playwright who can do that artfully and not, as you say, stand and deliver,
yeah,
or who can find ways to bury that and reveal that and not make you aware that you've got a character reading exposition to you, is a true talent, and for someone as young as Connor is, he writes with real maturity.
Yeah. Okay, so these guys drink a lot, right?
Yes, they do.
With the exception of Sharky. So Sharky at the beginning of the play has not been drinking for 2 days. But the way that McPherson uses that is, as you say, it frees these guys up. It gives them the ability to act and behave in a way that anything is possible.
That's right.
But it never veers into the kind of drunken behavior. I mean, these guys are really high-functioning drunks.
That's right. These guys are pros.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've said there are a couple of these characters that, you know, Guinness probably runs more thickly through their veins blood.
Yeah.
And so it does. And in fact, it's a wonderful stage direction Connor gives at one point in the play. In the stage direction, he describes each of these characters and what a particular kind of drunk they are, how the alcohol affects each one of them. And that was a great direction to get from a writer. But as you suggest, it also allows for tempers to flare. Yeah. It allows for things to turn on a dime. Emotions, from happiness to sadness to anger, all move so much more fluidly with both the lateness of an hour and the effects of alcohol. And these guys, in their alcoholic ramblings, are able, even though they're in a small room with their mates, are able somehow mentally to leave them and this room behind and reveal some pretty private and personal things.
Yeah, that delineation of the way that they are experiencing their inebriation differently it's an astounding stage direction. And also that McPherson identifies these guys by what they drink, right?
That's
right.
You
know, so we've got Patty Powers and we've got Guinness, and then Nicky Giblin's drinking Miller.
Miller.
And I was talking to an Irishman, and he said, you know, that would be frowned upon in Ireland.
Well, one would think. And why, if you were in this pub culture of Dublin, would you insist on drinking Miller, you know? And, again, what that reveals about Nicky and his... He also sports what he calls a Versace jacket.
Yes.
So he's very much socially conscious. And part of the tension in the room it comes, as you know, because Nicky is currently dating or living with our main character Sharky's ex-significant other, and yet he's coming to play cards. And so Nicky feels very much second dog in the room, and is constantly trying to prove his mettle, I guess, with his Versace jackets and his exotic taste in beer.
Well, and he's set up for us as in the audience to be the villain of the piece in a way, I think, before he enters, which is well into the first act. You know, we think that the confrontation is going to be Sharky.
That's right.
And Nicky, since Nicky is now with, you know, Eileen, friends, I should say, Sharky's ex. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't turn out to be the case. It's actually the gentleman that Nicky brings with him, Mr. Lockhart, who ends up.
Yes.
And I was struck by the fact that Richard, before the entrance of Mr. Lockhart, puts a candle in the window, which is an Irish tradition, as you know, we know, that says to the traveler, there is space here.
That's right.
And it comes from the biblical story of Mary and Joseph looking for a room at the inn and not being able to find one. And in a way, it also says the Christ child is welcome here. This is Christmas time. This is an open house. So there's an openness to a spirit to come into the house before Mr. Lockhart arrives. Mr. Lockhart arrives, and we find out that he is not of this world and is, let's say, the devil, shall we?
Let's, if you like.
Yeah. He has inhabited the body of a man, but but he is an entity that is associated with hell.
That's right.
He talks about having played a game of cards with Sharky 25 years ago.
Yes.
After Sharky had committed a crime while he was drunk, beat up a vagrant, and we presume accidentally ended up killing the man.
Right.
Spent the night in jail and was released without charges the next morning. And he says that he's come to play Sharky again for his soul.
Right. Connor tells in interviews that there is a very old Irish tale that is a bunch of guys on Christmas Eve playing cards, and one of them drops a card, and when he bends over to pick it up, he notices that one of the strangers at the table has a cloven hoof. And he realizes that he's playing with the devil, and that's where the story ends. And Connor read that and knew that story, grew up with that story as part of his lore, and this play is sort of his expansion of that story of what might that guy be doing here. And it's so interesting as we've examined the play. Lockhart comes for Sharkey and comes for his soul, but through the playing of the play, we've really discovered that he can only take him if Sharkey allows it. In the Christian tradition, the absolute worst sin is despair. And as you suggest, Sharkey at one point puts a candle in the window, which indicates a flicker of hope in what is otherwise a bed of despair for this character. Also along the way, a gift arrives for Sharkey. And sometimes it's the smallest gesture from another human being reaching out that opens a light in our souls. And so Sharkey, who begins our play on the dry for 2 days, feeling absolutely horrible because of it, and in such great despair, he has screwed up pretty much everything in his life. And as he lays in bed at night with his nightmares for having killed this man, I think he is driven very close to suicidal despair, which may in fact open the door for Lockhart to even come this night. And so the battle is really with Sharkey and his demons.
That's so perfect for our season two, based on the imagination. It was explored in Kafka on the Shore, the fact that we think of these worlds as being two different worlds, but actually they exist together. And whether that's waking and dreaming, or living and dead, or heaven and hell, they share mutual space within us and between us.
That's exactly right. And for a playwright, when they're able to capture that, as in Kafka or in this one, and to allow those things to inhabit the same space, it can be deeply unsettling, but it also gives us a perspective on ourselves and our souls, our collective conscious. And as you say, we think of those as some kind of wall between us and the other, and Connor kind of allows them to inhabit the same space.
Well, thanks so much, Randy, for talking today.
Great to chat with you.
Hope it's not long before you're back.
Me too.
Direct at Steppenwolf, and good luck. You'll be directing a production at the Geffen Playhouse, where you're artistic director of the Seafair. You'll be revisiting it this spring, right?
That's right. And I'm thrilled that John Mahoney and Tom Irwin, two of the characters that are in the play here at Steppenwolf, are going to be joining me out there. And so if any of the Steppenwolf fans are in Los Angeles in April and May of next year, stop in at the Geffen and see how these guys look with a few other cast members, but with much more history with the parts.
Yeah, great. And if you want more information on the Seafair, you can visit www.steppenwolf.org. AT&T is the sponsor of online content at steppenwolf.org.